I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel. We caught up with him in Culver City, California this week.
Yep.
Also with us, that's right, from NPR West, film writer, actor, and producer Rick Nahara. In Pittsburgh, Lenny McAllister's back with us. He's contributed to 4802 Final Friday on WQED. He's also a Republican strategist. And here in Washington, D.C., Corey Dade, contributing editor for The Root. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm out here, Hollywood swinging. But fellas, the rest of yous, what's up? Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Great to be here.
What's going on, Jimmy?
What's up, big time?
Hey, man, you know how I do it, man. But, you know, check this out. You know, some of us actually know John Ridley because, hello, he's been in the shop before. You might want to go into NPR.org and pick that out. But now he's getting his due for his work in 12 years as Slave. He's a monster writer. Here he is accepting the Oscar for that adapted screenplay. Kick it.
All the praise goes to Solomon Northup. Those are his words. That is his life. All the thanks goes to the entire crew, the entire cast.
Ah, my man. The Academy likes his work, obviously. But Ridley, you know, not for nothing, over the years, but just recently, he's come under the fire again for his personal take on who calls modern-day N-words. Michelle, really?
Well, that was an elegant way around the issue, but here's the issue that he wrote in 2006 an Esquire article titled The Manifesto of Ascendancy for the Modern American Ends, and you'll have to fill in the blanks to know which word I'm substituting. We are making the choice not to use that word because that conforms to our standards. I don't feel it. I think everybody knows what we're talking about. Ridley himself used the word repeatedly in the essay. And so just to let people know, that's what we're going to talk about. And if they find this uncomfortable, I understand. But you have to know that that's what we're talking about. So here's a little bit of what he wrote. Let me tell you something about N-words. The oppressed minority within our minority, always down, always out, always complaining that they can't catch a break, notoriously poor about doing for themselves, constantly in need of a leader but unable to follow in any direction that's navigated by hard work, self-reliance. And though they spliff and drink and procreate their way onto welfare doles and WIC lines, N-words will tell you their state of being is no fault of their own. He goes on. And then he says it's time for ascended blacks to wish N-words good luck, just as whites may be concerned with the good of all citizens but don't travel their days worrying specifically about the well-being of hillbillies from Appalachia. We need to send N-words on their way.
Michelle, thank you. I wonder where all the critics were 7 years ago.
Well, no, they were there. No, they were there. There was a very robust response then. But, you know, there's a difference between a long essay in Esquire by a writer who's also an essayist, you know, for NPR and so forth, and somebody who's an Oscar winner. So, yes, this essay has resurfaced.
First of all, let's go in on Esquire. Shame on Esquire for rarely giving black writers any space, but to talk about their blackness. Shame on you for that. But, yo, John Ridley, guess what? He's just a Cosby conservative. He's teetotaling that talented 10th tee, and I'm okay with that. That's his right. If he believes he's better than other black people, like, he's not alone. I mean, there are a lot of black people that feel like that, and he's able to catch a lot of ink, like in magazines like an Esquire, because it's easy for us to get in magazines when we criticize each other. We bring these intra-racial community conversations out into the zeitgeist. So, I mean, kudos for catching that ink, and I'm okay with whatever opinion he's got. So what? He didn't say anything new, and this has always been how he's felt. And this conversation is happening right now, cuts to pearls in barbershops all across America. So, you know, on to the next. Corey Dade, I know you have a lot to say about this, so man, go ahead.
You mean you also have a lot to say about this?
Man, you know, it amazes me that that he's asking the black talented ones of us to turn our backs on those who are less talented or less successful. No one in any other group is being required or asked to do that. Whites aren't told, turn your back on other white people who are less successful than you. And quite frankly, my success or my ascendance, as he calls it, doesn't depend on another black person being descendant or not actually achieving. So bump that. I can do both. I can care and help the people who are less fortunate and still achieve. One doesn't hurt the other. But I think it's interesting that Esquire decided to put this out this week. That's what's so interesting. It's sort of this mercenary sort of effort to build page views on their website, because they know here's a Oscar winner who wrote about black people in a screenplay and everyone loves him, and now we can show his true colors. To me, at the end of the day, what it just shows is a writer can really write beautifully about a topic and park his personal views.
Yeah, I mean, I think he wrote really beautifully.
Go ahead, Rick.
I was impressed by his writing ability.
He's still a prick, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whoa.
Wow.
We'll take that off the list of things. Okay, go ahead. Rick, go ahead.
I'm an ascended Latino, so I can look back. I'm ascended Latino. And the way I look at it is I don't forget the Latinos that are being deported, the 2 million that are being deported, and all the Latinos that are poor, and all the Latinos that have less education. Part of leadership is caring about all your people,
that's right.
And that's what he's not doing. He's not really showing black leadership by not caring about all the black people. And I have to tell you, those so-called N-words, and I'm not comfortable with the word unless I'm hanging out with Paula Deen in the Deep South.
Wow.
But I will tell you one thing. With this guy, I look at that and I go, you have failed bringing up your people, because those so-called N-word people also become people that a generation later are the John Ridleys and everyone else.
That's right.
One way to look at it, because I was a kid growing up with five kids in one bedroom in one time, and now I'm not. It's called cultural evolution, and that's what he's not putting in as a factor in this.
Mr. McAllister!
Rick's on point, and it's ironic that he would win an Oscar for writing a screenplay regarding the ascendancy from slavery in one guy's injustice in his personal life and how he was able to work through that. That is, in many ways, the epitome of what many people in Black America need to do. And to me, I see this as akin to being the guy that holds the neck of a struggling person trying not to drown underneath the water and saying, how come you don't know how to swim? Mm. The person continues to kick and flail, is doing the best they can, but they don't have the power to get that off of them, and then the person that's supposed to be helping them is part of those holding that head underneath the water saying, gasp for air, how come you can't swim? These things anger me. When I see it politically on the Republican side, the conservative side, it angers me. It angers me when I see it within the African American community. We are not at a place in time to continue to have that type of talk. Elevate people. This was a moment where he should have been able to take a platform and elevate those. Instead, because of these past views, nobody's quite being elevated, and even the team that he was on was split in regards to him winning this daggone Oscar. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Can I ask Rick about that for a minute, though? You've heard now that it has surfaced about this whole question about this feud between him and the producer-director Steve McQueen, and which they kind of successfully concealed to this point. Apparently this is over writing credit, that Steve McQueen wanted writing credit, and John Ridley just felt he shouldn't have it. I mean, I don't know how all that works in Hollywood, is that a common thing for there to be this kind of beef? I mean, what people were looking at was the body language Oscar night, and it just seemed that there was a lot of tension there. So.
Well, the common beef is that with the Writers Guild and writers, they look at it, a director may say a film by the director's name. And that's kind of the problem, because a film is by writers, and that's where it starts.
Well.
And there's two different ways to look at it. A writer creates the base, the soup base, and someone comes in, a producer says, add carrots, and another producer comes in and says this. So people are constantly adding into this soup. But the original idea or the adaptation comes from the writer, and that has to be protected, because a lot of times writers are pushed off the screenplay whenever they can be. It happened to me. I've had people push me off or had to fight for my credit and things like that. That's why the Writers Guild has an arbitration committee that they arbitrate. But I'll tell you one thing, is that was the writer is the first one who starts this whole process, and it's a lonely process. And in his case, I think it would start off on a spec.
Right. I mean, there was not even any money guaranteed.
It wasn't money guaranteed. It was that he had to deliver the product before he would be paid for it.
Yeah. And not for nothing, Rick, remind people that it's not just a name on a piece of paper that says, if you share credit with somebody, that equates to a check.
That's right.
Oh, well, yeah, let me just ask though. I totally understand that point. But does this change any way our thinking about this film, or do you? I mean, I know this wasn't your pick for Best Oscar, and we don't need to replow that ground. But does it change how we feel about all this? Or do we care? Do we care?
I think what it is is it's typical Hollywood. Let's find the rumor, the scandal. Let's bring this up, and they were right to try to keep this beef under wraps. Because tell you the truth. It takes away from the fact that the man wrote and adapted a great screenplay, and a director directed a great film. That's what happens, and that's why these things are secondary. And you know, it's kind of like the envidia culture within the Latino world. Sometimes we get very envious of each other because we think there's only one pie. And I always say, make more pies. And the same thing happens in the black culture as well. You've got two guys that should be so much celebrating their success, and now they're fighting over crumbs, and it makes it their whole film look in a bad light, and that's what's ridiculous about it.
Can I ask you just very briefly before we're going to move on, though, does this revisiting this essay change your feelings about the accomplishment of the film or about how you feel about the film, Corey?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm judging him as a man that is more of a classist. I mean, I look at it as more of a class issue. Yeah. It's like me looking at saying, I don't like cholos. Oh, these darn cholos. And I think the best one who said it was Chris Rock when he did in his comedy special. He talked about it. Mm-hmm. And I think people like that, this is where you do it in the comedy. And for the Esquire, a very white magazine, to bring this up, it just gives fuel to the other side who actually agrees with him, and for all the wrong reasons.
That's right.
Okay. You're listening. We're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, journalist Corey Dade, Republican strategist and talk show host Lenny McAllister, and film and television writer and producer Rick Nahara. Back to you, Jimmy.
All right. So, moving on from Hollywood to the courtroom. New Jersey teen Rachel Canning, for some reason, is suing her parents for child support. She's 18, but get this, she wants financial support to cover her living costs, private high school tuition, and access to her college fund. Oy. Michelle,
well, you know,
really?
I honestly, we talked about this with a group of women commentators the other day, and I just was curious to see if you all had a different take on it. A judge ruled Tuesday that her parents do not have to cover her current expenses, but they scheduled another hearing in April. And as, you know, with most family feuds, this is complicated. Let's stipulate we probably don't know the whole story, but Rachel says her parents abandoned her when they threw her out of the house after she experienced years of verbal abuse. Her parents say she left because she didn't like their rules, including a curfew and so forth. And I'm just interested in your perspective on this.
Part of this is the parents asked her to stop dating a bad boy. And, you know, anytime you ask your daughter or demand that your daughter stop dating a boy, you know, that never ends well. But it has sort of all the markings of a big TV drama. But what I think is interesting here is that, you know, her legal costs are being paid for by her best friend's father. Now, that's who she's staying with right now. And usually adults do not want to inject themselves into other people's family business. So I wonder if there's stuff that he knows that makes him willing to support her effort. But to me, it sounds like, you know, she wants it both ways. She wants to be an adult, but she wants that support. She may not be ready for adulthood if that's the way she feels.
As a dad, I'm just going to sit there and say there are also adults that will get involved in a situation and say, this is almost like a foster child. And if they can get $650 a week in child support, I think that's the number that she was asking for, I get a slice of that. I can put this away. It can pay for our home bills, everything else. I don't want to assume that this family friend is being altruistic. I'm looking at it as this young lady, from what I've read, was on the honor roll in a good school, was about to go to college. She's now throwing a hissy fit, and she apparently left the house 2 weeks or so before she turned 18 years old.
That's right.
In large part because of a curfew, and they didn't want her to continue dating a guy that was a bad influence on her. That's reasonable with parents. Those are the type of parents in 20 years you hug and say, thank you for not allowing me to blow up my life. And now she wants to have a hissy fit and run into courts. You can only do this in 2014 because 20 years ago, she had just been grounded for twice as long as the period of time as she initially was, and every other parent around her would have been like, listen to your mom and dad, they love you. Rather than this being played out in the newspapers and in social media, it's ridiculous. And you know, as a parent, you want to make sure that the courts support your right as a parent to bring up your child, as long as you're not breaking criminal laws. And I don't see or hear anybody saying that these two parents broke any criminal laws.
I'm worried about my kids suing me for not taking my son to the Transformer movie.
I know. It's just a matter of time before my 15-year-old starts suing me for not buying her another pair of jeggings or some Hello Kitty mess. You know what I mean? It's just a matter of time. This opens up a door I'm not comfortable with.
I hope my daughter's not listening.
Can I throw out another idea, though? Can I just throw out another idea? You know, the fact is that we have been at a time when a lot of people didn't have standing to make their case publicly, okay? I mean, first it was that black people didn't have access to the courts, or they did under very limited circumstances. Then women didn't have access to the courts unless they were validated by a man. And as, you know, upsetting as the idea may sound, is it a sort of an evolution of the idea that maybe children have fundamental human rights, that they have a right to air?
Well,
they are not adults.
She's 18. She's not a child.
Go ahead, Rick.
But
tell
then
them why
we prosecute. How many people do we prosecute as adults who are children?
That's
but
right.
We never.
Well,
that doesn't make that right.
But let me finish my point. But no matter how brilliant a minor is, we don't let a minor sit on a jury, right? But we prosecute minors as adults when we've decided that their behavior is heinous. And so I'm just wondering whether you like the facts of this or not, whether this is whether it's worth considering her point of view.
I think I am considering her point of view, but if you look at what's been filed in court, I'm not seeing abuse. I'm not seeing sort of the factors that would suggest that she has grounds to get support based on abuse. Now, I think she has grounds to get support, financial support, simply because she is their daughter, and they want her to go to school. They want her to go to college. So, yes, they should be actually supporting that effort financially. I believe that in general. Now, should it be litigated in a courtroom? To me, there has to be some kind of abuse or neglect that justifies that, and I don't see it.
She's 18. My dad would have said, join the Army.
Nice. That's your dad's a peach.
They would have said that.
Well, that's... That's the thing.
If you're for the post office,
If you're going to be adult enough to leave the house, then you have to be adult enough to take on the other responsibilities. Mm-hmm. You know, and what you brought up, Michelle, I think in many regards, the courts are wrong. You have a 15-year-old that commits a heinous act. They're still 15 years old and incapable of making true adult decisions and being rational like a true, full-fledged adult. So I think actually the court's going in the wrong direction, and we do not want to continue to repeat that mistake.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now because we are adults and we always make good decisions, right?
Yes.
Right. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Corey Date is a contributing editor for The Root. Lenny McAllister is a Republican strategist and contributor to 4802 Final Friday on WQED in Pittsburgh. Rick Nahara is a film and television writer, a producer, and the author of Almost White, Forced Confessions of a Latino in Hollywood. Thank you all so much.
Yes, sir.
God
Thank
bless.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast that's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.